I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the financial turmoil on Wall Street and on Main Street. We'll hear how some local school systems are struggling to make ends meet. Some districts are shortening the school week. But first, to Wall Street, which is reeling from several recent financial earthquakes, Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, Bank of America's purchase of Merrill Lynch, and troubles at American International Group, or AIG, have sent stocks tumbling after the market's open today. Peter Coy is economics editor at Business Week. And Peter, can you put this into context for us?
Sunday had to be one of the craziest days in the history of Wall Street. Here's the nation's biggest brokerage firm deciding the safest course is to agree to a $50 billion merger. Lehman Brothers, one of the senior firms, 158-year-old company, going to be wound down now, we hope uneventfully, and American International Group going to the government asking for money.
Let's take these a little bit one at a time. Merrill Lynch, this huge takeover by Bank of America. Bank of America just took over Countrywide. What's going on here?
To me, the big picture question is, where is the money going to come from for future lending to consumers and businesses? Bank of America is being saddled with, as you mentioned, Countrywide and now Merrill. Will that diminish Bank of America's ability to provide credit?
Right. Well, isn't Bank of America just assuming the same risk?
Right. A lot of people are saying that the way this eventually unwinds is fresh capital coming into the financial system. And the two most natural places for that to come from are the huge pools of money controlled by countries like Saudi Arabia, China, and so on. And secondly, from the U.S. government itself, which, of course, means the taxpayer, you know, massive purchases of bad assets by some successor to the Resolution Trust Corporation, which was the organization that helped end the S&L crisis of the 80s. These huge losses have destroyed a lot of capital and left many of these firms relatively thinly capitalized. And when they don't have enough capital, they can't lend. And if they can't lend, the economy can't grow.
Now, when you said that what needs to be done is that more money needs to, fresh money needs to be brought into the system, some of it from the U.S. government, does the fact that the U.S. government was not going to go along with any kind of a bailout for Lehman Brothers suggest that that's not going to happen?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. The government does not want to come in as the sugar daddy bailing investment bankers out of their bad decisions and keeping them in their fancy homes in Greenwich. On the other hand, it does not want to allow financial firms to go under in a way that drags down the entire U.S. and global economies and cut off our noses to spite our faces. The answer is that the Treasury Department is going to be trying to think of a way that it can buy up bad assets without making it a free ride for the people who made the bad loans in the first place.
And what about then AIG? We're hearing that American International Group is also having problems and there's going to be a major restructuring there. How does that fit into the picture?
AIG is in a whole separate category. It's neither an investment bank nor a commercial bank. It's an insurer primarily. The insurers had been seen as being in quite good shape. AIG was always a paragon of virtue when it came to financial stability, but they got sucked into credit default swaps, basically in the mortgage market, a lot of exposure in markets that they probably shouldn't have gotten nearly so deep into.
And so where do you think things are going to stop? I mean, are we at the bottom yet? We've got, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. I mean, where do we end here?
We're not going to hit bottom until new money comes into the financial system, which means we need money either from big foreign investors who have accumulated enormous amounts of dollars, literally trillions of dollars over the years, or the U.S. government itself is going to have to step in, and that means the U.S. taxpayers. We are not going to hit bottom until one or both of those things happens.
So what do you think then we'll see in the meantime?
I think we're going to see short sellers probing, looking for other potentially weak players. And we're going to see fire sales of assets as companies that are desperately trying to shore up their balance sheets sell whatever they can to raise money. And, of course, that creates a downward spiral because then other companies with similar assets have to write them down. That hurts their capital. You can really get into a scary downward spiral until somebody steps in and puts a halt to it.
Well, Peter Coy, economics editor for Business Week, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The economic downturn has led to a $48 billion gap in state budgets across the country, which means funds to public education are on the chopping block. The American Association of School Administrators surveyed schools this summer and found 13% are eliminating bus service, 35% are consolidating bus routes, and 44% are cutting back on field trips. Schools are also eliminating sports programs, charging more for lunches, even switching to a four-day school week. We're going to check in with several school districts today. First is Miami-Dade County, which is the nation's fourth largest. It's home to 340,000 students. The school district had a nearly $300 million shortfall this year, forcing it to cut programs and eliminate 2,000 positions. Last week, the superintendent was fired. Dr. Larry Feldman is a former school principal in Miami-Dade County. After he retired, he offered to come back to work for $1 a year plus benefits. The school district turned him down, but that publicity helped him win a spot on the school board, and he takes office in November. Welcome, Dr. Feldman.
Thank you, Deborah.
We've been talking about the whole subprime mortgage mess and the credit crunch, and it's our understanding that it's hit South Florida particularly hard. How is it affecting your school district?
Our schools determine their funds based on the property tax collected by the district. Most of our homes were at a high price. They were overpriced in terms of their value, and there was no problem. Now that the market has fallen apart, the property tax itself has fallen, and so the money that comes to us is much less.
Can you tell us what sort of cuts have been made in your school system to deal with all this budget mess?
Our student-teacher ratio went from a state 18 to 1 in primary grades to 22 to 1, and it kept going higher into the intermediate grades of 25 to 1. In terms of lunchroom, I believe we added an additional 50 cents to the existing, I think it was $1.20, $1.25. The use of school buses for field trips has gone up, and most of the hourly work that we've had with paraprofessionals to tutor, keep the media centers open, have been cut back.
So where do you go from here then?
I think we have to streamline our central office. I believe that we need to look at all programs that are not essential and not urgent and put those on the back burner. I believe we need to look at a better way of delivering education. There might be an opportunity for some of the students who are able to do the work at an alternate site while they're interning. There's also a deep sense in our particular district that unless we find another source of revenue besides property taxes, we will be hurting for quite a while.
We've heard from districts, some of them are having shorter school weeks. They're looking at some of the extracurricular programs, and there are other ways that school districts are trying to make up for their budget problems. Are you considering any of those types of ideas?
I believe the board, at least once I get on, what we'll be looking at are basically how to streamline the system. We've asked that during the upcoming summer program, we look at a four-day work week. Most of our maintenance, actually all of our maintenance, is on a four-day work week, and they get their job done.
So a four-day week wouldn't be classroom time necessarily. That would be over the summer.
Well, we're going to go ahead and try it over the summer.
Looking forward anyway, what you're doing really is sort of an overview of the whole system to see where you can streamline, and you think you'll be able to net enough savings from that to deal with this budget issue?
This person who was elected, not yet sworn in, happens to believe that there are enough funds in the budget as it occurs now that we would be able to make up a lot of the deficits that we have. There's a way of restructuring how we deliver substitute services when a teacher is out. You know, there are administrators in the building that are teachers. There are additional special area teachers that could then cover. So there's a way of doing it so we don't reduce our educational delivery.
Now, it's my understanding that a couple of years ago, Miami-Dade was ranked the lowest in the state, and things have improved over the past couple of years. Can you maintain that level of educational achievement while streamlining is underway?
I don't think we have a choice. I think we have to. If we start lowering the bar at all, then it's the students who are not able to keep up that we're going to lose, and those are the ones we need to put some additional resources with. I believe that Dade County Public Schools as a whole will continue to move forward because the teachers and the administrators at the school sites are truly dedicated and go beyond even the call of duty. One of the problems is that Florida, I believe, is the 50th state in the country, the last state in what we spend per child as far as education, and that's disgraceful.
Dr. Larry Feldman, he was recently elected to the Miami-Dade County School Board, and he spoke with us about some of the budget problems facing his school district. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Dr. Feldman.
You're very welcome.
Well, we mentioned the possibility of switching to a four-day school week, and that's already happened in at least 14 districts across the country, including the McCray school system in rural Minnesota. The 700 students there now have classes Tuesday through Friday, which could save up to $100,000 in fuel costs. Greg Schmidt is superintendent there. And Greg, how has the school day changed this year?
It used to be that we started school at 8:15, and now it's at 8 o'clock. And instead of ending at about 3:15, we end at 4:04. And that's to make up the additional time for the days that we lost.
So about an hour a day longer.
65 minutes, yeah.
Okay, and how's everybody adjusting?
It's going pretty well. I think probably the biggest change that people are seeing is that with our extracurricular activities after school, you know, the evening becomes shorter because there's less time at home with families, and I think kids are tireder, but I think overall it's going quite well.
Was that something that had to be negotiated with the teachers' union?
It really didn't. Our teachers' contract simply said that the school day was 30 minutes before kids came and 30 minutes afterward. There was a memorandum of understanding that was written to address the number of actual work days, but teachers didn't have any issues with that, so we're pretty encouraged with that.
So let's talk about how this saves money.
Well, primarily it's due to transportation. The 23 days that we have less than last year will save us about $3,000 a day. The other thing is we believe that we'll have fewer staff absences because many of them will schedule appointments on our day off.
Would you say that fuel prices are the biggest stress on your budget?
I would say yes. We spent $120,000 more last year than we did the year before. So we talk a lot about, you know, more efficient things that can be done with the boilers and how can we work with the thermostats. One of the things that we're going to do this winter is we're going to make sure that on our three-day weekends that we turn the thermostats down to 60 degrees. I think in the past we've had them a few degrees warmer than that.
We've heard that there are a lot of districts looking at things like cutting back on sports teams, perhaps different language classes or extras or specials or whatever the district might call them. Are you doing those things as well?
Yes, we are. Just over a year ago, we cut $800,000 from our budget. This past year, we cut about $300,000. So we've been looking at lots of different options. We've cut things in the extracurricular area. We've reduced the number of coaches. We're trying to look at not traveling as far for some of the contests as we have in the past. In some cases, with teams that are smaller, we're taking 2 10-passenger vans versus a bus because we can save money there. So we're looking at lots of options. Every day, I think we're looking at what can we do to reduce the budget.
Well, Greg Schmidt, superintendent of the McCray School System in Minnesota, where the system just implemented a four-day school week to help balance the budget. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Deborah.
And just ahead, school budgets in sports. Coaches in California are asking alumni to help pay for footballs. And later in the show, more about the shakeup shaking Wall Street. It's Here and Now. We're talking about how the economic slump is affecting schools. In California, the state legislature is expected to end its 77-day budget deadlock tonight. While lawmakers were trying to close a $15 billion budget gap, schools were left not knowing how much money to expect, so districts held off on rehiring thousands of teachers, and in some schools, class sizes increased to between 35 and 40 students. Many systems also cut back on extracurricular activities like sports. And for more on that, we have two high school coaches on the line. Dan Armstrong is athletic director at La Quinta High School, which is just south of Palm Springs. Welcome, Dan.
How are you doing? Thanks.
Also with us is John Rice. He's football coach at the Rialto Eisenhower School, which is about an hour and a half away from Dan, and it's near San Bernardino, California. Welcome, John.
How are you?
I'm okay, thanks.
How are you doing, Coach?
Good, John. How you been?
Hey, struggling, man, just trying to get a football.
I understand, John, that you had to send out a plea to alumni for help because of the budget problem. Can you explain?
Yes, we have a crisis this year with the funding situation at the state level trickling down, and I was told we needed to find an alternative source just to get football. So with my hat in my hand and a little bit embarrassed, went to our alumni, which we have some very proud alumni with a 50-year history, and just ask them if they could raise some money for us to buy some footballs, which is the most basic need we have, and they came through, and they've been a blessing.
How much?
Oh, well, it was about $600, that was all.
$600?
Yes.
It doesn't seem like very much.
Well, you know, of course, we have several teams on campus, and the money needs to be divided up evenly. I certainly don't want us to take away from other sports, but at the same time, when you're going to field a sports program, you know, the district is responsible for supplying those things. So, you know, things are tied all over.
Well, they are tied all over. Many schools are grappling. How many sports teams do you have?
In the neighborhood of 20. An interesting side note, in our district, they were going to cancel a swimming program because of the money situation at a neighboring school. There was an uproar at the district level, and a lot of parents went to a board meeting, and they reinstituted it.
Reinstituted the swimming program.
Yes.
And Dan, maybe you can address this. Has anyone thought about charging an athletic fee to parents? Because here I know some parents are charged about $300 a sport for kids to be able to play.
Well, yeah, that's on the table. There's no question, a pay-to-play program. So, I mean, we're looking at all avenues. Transportation, we're cutting out the number of tournaments we allow our teams to travel to. We're trying to get more parent participation in transportation. I mean, there's kind of no stone unturned right now. We're open to all options.
In our situation, if I may, if they did require kids to pay to play, we would have a disaster here because we have some struggling families, and
exactly.
It's just not economically feasible in our area to have parents come up with that money. They're struggling to get their kids the basic necessities, and I think it would create a gulf between the haves and the have-nots.
Well, I guess we have to say, how important is high school football then in your area to some of these kids? John?
I'm old school, and I think that winning and losing is certainly important, but we're trying to teach the old-fashioned lessons of self-discipline, perseverance, working with others. The alternative is boredom and possibly getting into trouble, and they love to be here. And we have kids that don't want to go home from practice, and it would just be a disaster if that happened.
And what about for these kids to go on to the college level? Is that something that happens frequently from either of your schools?
Yeah, Eisenhower is storied for the number of kids that have gone on and played in college and in the NFL, Ronnie Lott, you know, being one of them. We've been fortunate that we've had, in our short history of 12 years that we've been open, we've had 23 kids get Division I scholarships, and at one time or another we had three kids playing in the NFL. So obviously, yeah, it's real important for these kids to get those opportunities.
Dan, John talked about asking alumni for $600 for football. What kind of fundraising do you have to do?
Ours is right around $35,000 for football. Our biggest fundraiser, and it's worked real well, and people are starting to, you know, copy us really, is that we have each one of the kids in our football program go out in the community and sell an advertisement for our program book that we sell at the games. We're trying to be creative as much as we can, you know, as far as, you know, raffles, silent raffles, golf carts, same things that everybody else is doing, but we have had to cut our numbers, you know, football-wise, for the first time in the 12 years we've been here. We've had to post a traveling squad, which is really difficult for our freshmen. We have, you know, approximately 68 freshmen, but a bus only holds 54, so they won't allow us to take, you know, a second bus like we used to do a few years ago. So, you know, we have to post a traveling squad, and when a kid practices all week and then can't go to the game, that's really a tough situation.
Last year, the maximum we could come up with after about 3 years of trying was about $10,000, and that doesn't allow us to do everything we want to do. We're going without some equipment.
So in some places, I've heard that the coaches help. They help drive the buses. Is that an option, Dan?
Well, it wouldn't be for me because I'm not a very good driver. But, you know, I've just hired an assistant coach that was a head coach for 19 years in North Dakota, and that's what he told me. He said, I was the bus driver, the equipment manager, the trainer. You know, I was everything. And so he's obviously a great addition to our staff.
Is there a point when you say, you know, we can't cut anymore or outside fundraise anymore? If there's not more of a commitment, then maybe we can't do a sports program.
Well, let me tell you, when you have to ask for footballs, we're already at that point. I mean, I've been doing this for 25 years, and I understand things are tough, but I've been in four states, and I was just flabbergasted, and we're at that point right now. I just believe with all my heart and soul that sports are a worthwhile endeavor for society, and without our sports, society's going to be in big trouble. There's just so many good lessons that are learned and life skills, and I think if the priorities aren't set and we don't do something to keep these sports going and these kids out of the streets.
It sounds like you guys are on the same page here. Are you rivals on the field?
For years, Eisenhower was the benchmark of high school football around here, state champions, national champions, and so we aspire to get our program to their level. We've played a lot, and we've scrimmaged a lot, and you know, like I said, it's flattering for people to mention us in the same sentence with Eisenhower. So, but it's always been a friendly rivalry.
John?
Right now, I'd say Dan's program is probably doing a little bit better than ours. He's done a great job out there.
Well, there you go. John Rice, high school football coach in Rialto, California, and Dan Armstrong, high school athletic director and head football coach at La Quinta High School in California. Thanks to both of you for joining us, and good luck on the upcoming season. Well, as we've been reporting, Lehman Brothers, the fourth largest investment bank in the U.S., has filed for bankruptcy as a result of the subprime mortgage crisis. Lehman Brothers, which is 158 years old, survived the railroad bankruptcies of the 19th century, the Great Depression, and the collapse of long-term capital management in the 1990s. Meanwhile, the nation's largest insurer, AIG, the American International Group, is restructuring, and Bank of America is buying Merrill Lynch in a forced sale. Among the things being done in response, a global group of banks is creating a $70 billion fund to help, and the Federal Reserve is taking steps to make it easier for banks to borrow from the central bank. Well, with us is Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland School of Law, where he directs the Center for Homeland Security. Professor Greenberger was the director of the Division of Trading and Markets in the Clinton administration. Professor Greenberger, welcome.
Very nice to be here.
Well, you know, President Bush said today that what is happening in the financial markets right now, essentially, he calls them adjustments. Let's listen to what the president had to say.
In the short run, adjustments in the financial markets can be painful, both for the people concerned about their investments and for the employees of the affected firms. In the long run, I'm confident that our capital markets are flexible and resilient and can deal with these adjustments.
So, Professor Greenberger, that was President Bush speaking about what's happening in the financial markets. What are your thoughts on the health of, and resiliency of our financial system?
Well, I think the president's message does a disservice to the United States taxpayer, and for that matter, people around the world who are concerned about their economies. This is more than an adjustment. This is probably the most devastating set of events that have happened to the American economy since the Great Depression. We've been consistently told at each turn in the curve that once you get by this turn, all will be well. We were told it last summer when the subprime meltdown began and the Fed started to develop extraordinary measures to extend capital. We were told it after the government rescued Bear Stearns. We were told that after Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were essentially nationalize, whatever the technical term the administration may have used. And today, for the first time, we have a very large investment bank going into bankruptcy, which is something the administration dearly wanted to avoid because they know that it will cause the unraveling of a lot of complex financial instruments that probably aren't worth what a lot of financial institutions are saying they're worth, and there are a series of other financial institutions that are in dire situation. I think the American taxpayer needs to be told in bold and direct terms that we're bordering on the brink of having to nationalize our financial system.
Well, it sounded like the president was essentially saying today, no more government bailouts of Wall Street. Do you think that the government should have taken steps to bail out Lehman Brothers?
The truth of the matter is, I think they were right not to bail out Lehman Brothers, and I hope they're right that this means the end and the normal free markets will take care of this problem. The reason I don't think that's going to be the end result, and the reason I'm supportive of what they did is because I think this is going to lay bare for the American public what a dire financial stress we're under. What they were worried about and why they were dearly hoping that either Barclays or Bank of America or a combination of both would take Lehman Brothers over is they don't want one of these institutions to go into bankruptcy. And the reason they don't want these institutions to go into bankruptcy is they're loaded up with complex financial instruments that were all geared toward a bet that people who couldn't afford to pay their mortgages would pay their mortgages. And when those bad bets are exposed to real auditing and accounting that will come through the bankruptcy process, it will not only make clear that Lehman Brothers was bankrupt, but it's going to make clear that the assets within a lot of other financial institutions are not valued correctly. That is to say, they're overvalued. But I think, in truth, the American public needs the shock of understanding just how bad things are.
But, you know, many people may be saying, the many members of this public that you think need to be aware of the state of the financial system, they're probably saying, you know what, my money's insured. I don't have $100,000 in the bank right now. It's insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So do I really need to worry all that much about what's going on? Maybe it is an adjustment and it will settle down.
Well, there are limits to that insurance, just like any insurance company only has so much capital. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation only has so much funding set aside for this insurance, and they've already used a lot of it up on the few banks that have failed. They have, I am told, 300 banks on their watch list. Now, in truth, maybe you can rest easily because you know that the United States Congress will come to the rescue and will provide the FDIC with more money so that people's deposits can be insured. But what they're saving by making sure their deposits are insured, they're going to lose in higher taxes. This entire financial fiasco, which has come from imprudent government regulation as well as imprudent banking practices, will in the last analysis be laid at the footsteps of the United States taxpayer. It will have to come to the rescue. It will have to come to the rescue to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars.
Well, let's talk about commercial banks as well. Bank of America, which bought Merrill Lynch. Are the commercial banks, where do they stand in all of this? How can Bank of America be so healthy enough to do this? And are they okay?
Well, they're obviously they're not okay because they themselves are reporting losses. They're experiencing losses. Now, the benefit that the depository institutions have is they do have the deposits in there of people who are having checking accounts and savings accounts and money market funds. The problem with Lehman Brothers and the other investment banks is they don't have that cushion of deposits. And you will see today there's a lot of prognosticators out there saying the idea that you can have an investment bank that is a bank that has no depository role is fast coming to an end.
So what's the way out? Is more regulation the answer?
More regulation is the answer. What I fear is that people mouth the words more regulation, but they don't know exactly what to do. My view is that this entire subprime meltdown was built on complex financial instruments that the Bush administration purposely shielded from any accountability, oversight, or regulation. And I am fearful that even a democratically controlled Congress does not yet understand how that has all worked to the disadvantage of the American taxpayer. But if we do impose more regulation, that will only protect us for the future. We do right now have on our hands a bunch of serious losses that will have to be recompensed. And that isn't going to require regulation. That's going to require old-fashioned taxing of the American taxpayer to save the economy from a depression.
Michael Greenberger at the University of Maryland School of Law, where he directs the Center for Homeland Security. Professor Greenberger was also the director of the Division of Trading and Markets in the Clinton administration. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Here and Now. Communities in the path of Hurricane Ike are taking stock today in what a huge path it is. The hurricane caused dozens of deaths from the Gulf Coast to the Ohio Valley. More than a million homes and businesses are without power. And in Texas, the biggest search and rescue operation in state history continues today. More than 50 helicopters and 1,500 search and rescue teams are involved. Around 2,000 people have been rescued so far. Mary Flood is a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you, Deborah.
Well, Hurricane Ike hit Houston and the Texas coast very hard on Saturday. What does it look like in Houston today?
Well, in Galveston, it looks like a war zone. In Houston, it looks more like we planted a lot of trees badly right in the middle of our road. And it's very dark. I came to work at 6 a.m., and I actually, though I've lived here for almost 30 years, got lost on the way in because I couldn't see street signs. I couldn't see street lights. And it's a little scary.
So a lot of people still without power in the area.
Only one in four have power. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about a city of over 4 million people.
And the mayor of Galveston, of course, has been quoted as saying, do not come back to Galveston. You cannot live here right now. So war zone is what it looks like there?
War zone, ghost town. A lot of things were raised there. A lot of homes are gone. We only know of three deaths, but it would be a miracle if that's all we lost.
We do know that hundreds of thousands of people were evacuated before the hurricane, but some folks said they were going to stick it out, and now you have this massive search and rescue operation going on. What's happening with that, Mary?
They're going door to door to see if there's anybody in there. They don't know if everyone's accounted for yet or not, because there's always some chaos to all this in the days following it.
And so that's basically a massive effort that's concentrated where?
It's in Galveston and in the Bolivar Peninsula, and especially on the part of the islands down there that doesn't have a seawall, where there used to be a neighborhood of maybe 50 homes. Now there's one home and 49 concrete foundations.
So for the folks who did decide to leave, there are tens of thousands of people who did leave, and they went to shelters.
Hundreds of thousands. And some went to shelters in Dallas or places much further inland or north. A lot of people went to stay with relatives or in hotels. People went all over the place.
And are supplies getting to the shelters because of all this other destruction that's still on the ground? I mean, that must be a mammoth effort as well.
Actually, the shelters here in Houston opened late because the Red Cross has 150 places they can use as shelters. However, most of Houston is dark, and they couldn't use a place as a shelter when they couldn't turn on any electricity, and so they just opened some shelters locally yesterday.
Has that left people stranded with nowhere to go?
There may be some people stranded. I mean, there are people who are staying in homes that have leaking roofs, certainly. And a lot of the people who went immediately to shelters are special needs folks who needed to be able to plug in some appliance to help them live healthily. And a lot of other people are just dark and wet, and luckily we're having some non-humid days, which is so unlike Houston.
Now, we heard that there's a week-long curfew imposed in Houston. And obviously there's limited service from the airport. I mean, it's really a mess. And what are folks saying about how long it's going to take to try to clean up and start getting things back to some semblance of normal?
Well, we know that we aren't going to be really normal for more than a month. I mean, it just can't possibly be. At my own home, I mean, the fence is down and trees are down and lights are out. But there are little bits every day. Stunningly, I was happy to see the golden arches lit up because it was a sign of normalcy, too. And I passed two McDonald's on the way to work and thought, oh, I'd like seeing it lit up. I mean, they're piece by piece, step by step, we're coming back.
And what do you think, how do you think the storm has affected folks in Houston? Have they been frightened by it, would you say? Or have they come together around it, or is it too early to say?
I think both of those things happen. Because my name is Flood and editors have thought it funny, I've gone to dozens and dozens of hurricanes and been through them, and this one scared me more than any other one I've been in, and I think everybody was frightened by it. But yes, coming together is exactly what's happened. My street is half on electricity and half off, so you will see going across the street cables as those of us have electricity power the refrigerators and other appliances of our neighbors. People are, because they're out of electricity, have taken all the meat out of their freezers and are having barbecues in their front lawn and inviting neighbors they didn't know very well. And so right now, we're actually all getting to know each other probably better than we ever have. In a couple days, that's probably going to wear thin.
Mary Flood, reporter for the Houston Chronicle, thanks very much for speaking with us, and good luck, Mary.
Thanks, Deborah.
From a boiler factory in China to on stage at the Met, back in a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. When it comes to opera, China has a long tradition of its own. But until recently, few Chinese people seriously studied Western opera, especially during the turbulent Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, when all things Western were deemed spiritual pollution. So how does the Chinese son of staunch revolutionary parents, who end up being exiled from Beijing, survive all the turmoil of the Cultural Revolution and make it from the floor of a Beijing boiler factory where he worked to sing on the great stage of the Metropolitan Opera in New York? Well, that's the life story of our next guest, Hao Jiangtian, who became China's first world-class opera singer. Hao Jiangtian tells his life story in his memoir, Along the Roaring River, My Wild Ride from Mao to the Met. He's now appearing in The Bonesetter's Daughter, based on the Amy Tan novel, a new opera which premiered at the San Francisco Opera over the weekend. Today's New York Times says Tian stole every scene he was in.
Opens my tongue, the dead go to heaven without shame.
Hao Jiangtian, who goes by Tian, joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi. Hi. Good to be here.
Well, in your book, you outline quite a life story. Your parents fought for the Communist Revolution. They were prominent musicians in the People's Liberation Army. And you hated studying the piano when you were growing up. Your yeah. parents were exiled from Beijing. I mean, it's really quite a story. How do you think that whole experience of growing up really informs the singing that you do now?
Well, I think I always believe in experience for artists. My parents were sent away in 1969. I was only 13 years old. So I was home alone in Beijing. So I went wild and I started working in the factory for 6-7 years in the factory. And then I started, you know, my voice training. So I think what I saw, what I experienced, what I heard, and, you know, my family experience all, you know, helped, you know, my opera career step by step. And also, you know, as opera singer on stage, you have to, you know, let people feel what's deepest feeling in your heart. I think that's very, very important. For example, I arrived in New York City in 1983, December 16th. And I had never seen an opera. And the next day, actually, I only had $50 in my pocket. And I spent $8. I bought a standing pass. I went to the Metropolitan Opera.
And an older couple gave you their tickets, but you didn't understand why, because you couldn't speak English. Their tickets were where?
The tickets were for the middle of a fifth row, actually the best, most expensive tickets. Pavarotti was just in front of my face. So that was my first live opera experience, actually.
And then 10 years later, to the day, you are on stage with Pavarotti at the Met. You had a small part, and you tried to tell him how he inspired you. What happened?
So he kept saying, "Si, si, bravo, bravo." And then went into his dressing room and closed the door in front of my face. So I thought probably I did something wrong.
And then he did something during the curtain call, which surprised you. He waved everyone else on stage for their bows. And then what did he do?
And he waited until my turn, and he grabbed my hand and went out with me together.
Oh.
And he repeated that for the rest 7 performances.
Oh. Wow, well, that was an amazing story. So you know, let's talk about, though, how you got to New York in 1983, which is, it's a big jump from this 14-year-old boy who was working in a factory in Beijing with no parents when you were completely wild, and
yes.
when you obviously had these sort of romantic ideas about life that certainly weren't condoned during the Cultural Revolution. How do you go from there to 1983, landing in New York and spending $8 of your $35 on a ticket to the Metropolitan Opera?
That was a long march, actually. I found my voice, yes, just by accident. And that was 1975, the last year of a Cultural Revolution. And we didn't know what we would, what was the future of the country. You know, nobody knew. And one day I was on my bike to look for a friend. I didn't want to climb up to the fifth floor, so I was just shouting, you know, outside of the building, "Hey, are you home? Could you hear me?" So my friend was not home, and another window opened. A gentleman actually showed up at the window and started talking to me. And he told me, well, you should find a voice teacher and you may have a singing career. So actually, that 5 minutes changed my life. I found a teacher. I joined the first public audition for the Central Conservatory, and the competition was very keen because over 500 young singers joined the audition, and I was the lucky one.
Wow. Oh. You know, it can't be easy being a Chinese-based singing Western opera. There's
right.
all kinds of different things. Can you talk about that a little bit, about how you overcame some of those difficulties?
Well, the only thing is you have to keep fighting, trying, pushing yourself, because this is different, totally different culture for a Chinese singer. Also, you know, for basses, the most important roles in operas are tenor and the sopranos, you know.
Mm.
And as a bass, and we are always either a devil or, you know, crazy guy and something. Anyway, just don't give up. Yeah. Don't give up.
A happy ghost will cost you more.
And now, as we said, you're in The Bonesetter's Daughter. That's the new opera based on the Amy Tan novel. And, you know, it must be quite a big difference now to look around and see that you've got this opera, you've got Chinese-born opera singers now on stage. What does that feel like now?
Well, the role I'm playing is a Mr. Chan. It's a most evil character I have ever portrayed on stage. Bad guy. But, you know, probably because of my experience, I feel I could understand this bad guy. I could go deep in his heart to feel him. And I would do a good evil... I would be a good evil guy.
Well, best of luck to you, and thanks very much for speaking with
Thank
us.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
To the ink studio, where Chang's wood will burn to soot. For blackest ink, for smoothest stroke. For words that never fail.